of a human to win any victory she could prevent.
No, I'm going to stand here, enjoy the morning air, and transmit this document to Master Kenth Hamner, leader of the Order, a man who actually had a distinguished military career. Jedi Tetley can prepare Jedi Horn for transportation.
Well, if the captain could not be compelled to leave, perhaps he could be made to suffer for his impudence.
As she transmitted the warrant file and added a brief message to Master Hamner, Sil'Gall altered the nature of the impulses she was issuing into the Force. Instead of encouraging an emotional urge, she began promoting a biological one. The notion that the captain needed to visit the Refresher. To her compulsion, she added visual aids, including images of flowing streams, beautiful waterfalls, and steady, drenching rainfalls. The red suffusing the captain's face drained away, to be replaced by something like pallor.
Done with my warrant card yet?
No. I'm having some trouble with the message I'm adding. Typing on these things is difficult for a fish head, you know. By the way, do you call Didal Nizz a fish head? Is it a sign of affection? A nickname? What is your nickname? Is it Ori? May I call you Ori? Can I get you something to drink, Ori? A tall, cool glass of water, perhaps?
Even as she parked her airspeeder in a low-level hangar at the Jedi Temple, Jaina could feel agitation from above, a sort of atmosphere of un-Jedi-like worry and anger that filtered down through permacrete and durasteel like water filtering through coarse cloth. With her observer Dab beside her, obviously talking about the High Council decision, she rode the turbolift up. The agitation did not feel like a call to arms, did not seem like a physical emergency unfolding, so she forced herself not to reach for her lightsaber. It bothered her that her first impulse was to ready herself for combat. Despite their role in popular entertainment, that was not the way of the Jedi, even for their sword. She and Dab emerged into a darkened corner of the Great Hall, finding it full of Jedi who stood in small groups, talking in quiet tones. Jaina strode up to a nearby group of three Jedi, including Master Katarn.
Master, what's happened?
Kyle's expression was unperturbed, though he radiated a little anger. They've come for Valen. Jaina frowned.
I hadn't heard that we'd come to terms with the government about his evaluation.
We haven't. This is unilateral on the government's part. It's in retaliation for this morning's High Court decision.
But we didn't have anything to do with that.
Of course we did. If we had put pressure on Tahiri Vela to withdraw her appeal, all the pressure the Order could bring to bear, would she have continued?
Probably not.
Well, now we know what the government considers cooperation on our part. Unthinking acceptance of their decisions, silent obedience, preemptive groveling. From behind them came the sound of a turbolift arriving. Jaina turned as everyone else did. From one of the lifts emerged Master Kenth Hamner at the head of a short processional. He marched before a floating medical bed, its repulsor lips quiet and unobtrusive compared with those of airspeeders. Valen lay on the bed, conscious, covered to his neck by a sheet, and strapped in place. Flanking the bed were Jedi Tekley, Master Durin, and the bounty hunters Ku and Vax. A Jedi apprentice guided the floating bed from the rear. Valen was not a silent, immobile patient. He twisted and strained against his bonds, loudly talking all the while.
Look at you, all of you. You think you have everyone fooled, but you'll make a mistake. They'll see through your deception as I have. What have you done with the real Jedi? What have you done with the real horns? Did you kill them? Bring them back alive and unhurt, or I'll make you suffer. You'll suffer like you were swallowed by a sarlacc forever and ever, once I get my hands on you.
Another lift opened, disgorging a squadron of GA security troopers who swarmed forward and rapidly formed up around the procession. Dab recorded the progress of the bed and its guard.
They made a very public event of this,
he said, so quietly that Jaina barely heard him.
Not nice.
You have no room to talk.
Jaina's tone was angry.
You're part of the problem.
Unperturbed, he continued recording.
I'm qualified and even sympathetic. If I quit, who replaces me? Maybe a one-armed convict with a grudge against the Jedi, released from prison just for this job? Would you prefer that?
She didn't answer. Instead, like many of the Jedi present, she followed the procession. It reached the end of the hall and exited, passing Master Silgall and a human security captain who looked as though this assignment was making him miserable. Valen, still haranguing the onlookers, was loaded into the ambulance. The security operatives, medical personnel, and bounty hunters took their places in their vehicles. The captain, pallid and sweating, raised a hand to prevent Master Silgall and Jedi Tekly from boarding the ambulance. Then the caravan of official vehicles got into motion and was gone. As Master Hamner re-entered the hall and passed her, Jaina caught his eye. She whispered, "This is going to get worse and worse as long as we let it." He nodded, somber.
"And yet I have to stay on this course. I need to be able to look Chief of State Dollar in the eye and say, there is no resistance in the order to your measures. Just ask me, ask any master."
He continued on his way. Jaina felt a rush of elation. As stuffy as Master Hamner was, as creased and starched in his personality as any of his old dress uniforms, he did know what was needed. He wasn't just a stooge for the government.
"You look suddenly happy," Dab told her. "Ever been given permission to do what you planned to do anyway?"
"Sure. What were you given permission to do?"
"Have lunch," she lied.
Chapter 15. Calrissian Numba Mines, Kessel.
Half an hour later, a time that was mercifully uninterrupted by energy spiders, the bogies' residual energies that had crippled their electronics began to dissipate. The monitors in the speeder came up with patches of static. Leia tested her lightsaber, and it came on. Fitfully in the first few seconds, and then reassuringly steady. Han got behind the speeder's controls and tried to coax the vehicle into life. A few minutes later, its repulsors kicked in and lifted the vehicle off the floor. As Leia climbed in, Han mopped imaginary sweat from his brow.
Ready to go back up?
No, we haven't really found anything.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
While we were waiting, I felt more of them in the Force.
Bogies?
She nodded.
Deep, deep down. Maybe they're somehow related to the groundquake phenomenon. I've also traced paths of lower life forms that I think correspond to tunnels.
Going down, I assume.
That's the direction I was looking.
He sighed and put the speeder into motion.
Point the way.
Kilometers up and to the southeast, in the surface buildings of the Calrissian Numba Mines, Alana sat in a secondary conference room that had been pressed into service as a playroom. Chance was gone, having been bundled off by Nana for a nap. Alana was alone with C-3PO and R2-D2. She wanted to glare at them, but that would be showing her true feelings, and her mother, her real mother, had always said that only loved ones deserved or needed to see your true emotions. And not even them, if you needed to convince them of something.
"I'm tired of waiting," she told the droids. "I want to do something."
C-3PO looked down at her where she sat on the carpeted floor.
"While you are doing something, you're reading on your datapad."
She closed the electronic device with a definitive snap.
"No, I want to do something good. Something nobody's ever done before."
"I have done things that no one has ever done before. And I can assure you it's usually a dangerous and alarming sort of activity, not suited to little girls."
"What have you done?"
"Well, I have been mistaken for a golden god, and in so doing helped strike down the Galactic Empire. Let me tell you that story."
"No."
She grabbed her backpack, tossed in her datapad, and dragged out her breath mask.
"Let's go outside."
"Not advisable, young miss. Every new world is a place of new, uncatalogued dangers."
R2-D2 interrupted him with a series of notes.
"What did he say?"
Alana asked.
He asserted that we could protect you in the unlikely event of danger. In short, he undermined my already precarious authority.
Oh, very well. The outside offers no comfort, you know.
Maybe, but I like to bounce.
Kessel's gravity, lower than that of most worlds where humans settled, had given her the opportunity to make some extraordinary high leaps on the short walk from the Falcon to this building. Not that bounding had anything to do with her desire to go outside. Quietly, so as not to alert the Calrissians, Nia Nunba, or any of the occasionally glimpsed members of the skeleton crew Lando had on duty in the building, Alana led the droids down corridors that were so echoingly empty and dimly lit that they all but had signs pointing out that they were off-limits to little girls. Eventually, she found a hatch exit to the exterior, and moments later, she stepped out into the bracing chill of Kessel's atmosphere.
Time to bounce,
she announced.
As we are rather ill-suited to bouncing, and even more poorly engineered to land in a non-damaging fashion, I believe that R2 and I will simply watch from a safe distance.
Alana shrugged. She began moving in a straight line away from the main building, sometimes running with long steps, sometimes jumping for the fun of it, always heading away from the perceptions of adults. Soon, her shoes and the lower parts of her pant legs were covered in the white powder that seemed to be everywhere. Now it was time to do as Leia had begun to teach her, to open her mind and feelings. It was hard for her, because she had always had reason and usually encouragement to stay bottled up. Sometimes her life had depended on it. Scary people were less likely to sense weakness or fear if you remained bottled up. The ground ahead and to the left was darker. She changed direction to head that way, and soon found herself at the edge of what looked like a series of stone outcroppings, jagged brown rocks protruding from the white dust. The ground was jumbled, rising and falling. This area wasn't pretty, but it was better than more white sand. Cautiously, she moved out among the broken stones.
Miss Amelia!
She heard C-3PO cry plaintively. She turned and saw the golden droid, R2-D2, beside him, a couple of hundred meters back. She waved to them, as though she welcomed their presence and had absolutely no intention of keeping clear of them, then headed farther into the outcroppings, picking up her pace. Deeper in, rocks were taller, some as tall as she was. She gracefully moved among them and soon was completely out of sight of the droids. Occasionally, she would hear C-3PO calling or R2-D2 tweedling, and she would extend a hand above the level of the rocks, wave, and shout, then immediately head off to some other spot. After a few minutes, she became aware of something not too far away. It felt different from people and animals. It was a stillness, unlike anything she had felt before. Cautious, she headed toward it, moving as quietly as she could. A few dozen meters later, the ground became white and flat again. She moved out into an oval clearing surrounding a building. It was not tall, barely twice her height, and since the clearing was in a depression in the ground, she doubted that its slightly peaked roof would poke up above the surrounding rocks. It was made of gray-white stone. It had four walls and was not large enough to be a house, perhaps more the size of a storage shed. She circled it and found that there were no viewports, just beveled depressions in the stone, suggesting where viewports might someday be cut out, and no door. Though on the west face, the outlines of a door had been incised in the solid stone. The edges of the bevels and incisions, the corners of the walls and roof, were worn and rounded, giving the building the impression of tremendous age. Alana took a deep breath. This was a storage shed of a sort. A storage shed for dead people. A tomb. It did not need a working door or viewports. But whoever had constructed it had given it the semblance of such things, as if the dead needed them. Dead things did not worry her, but she had seen, when she was not supposed to be awake, parts of many holodramas in which dead things in tombs turned out to not be dead after all, and it took brave, roguish heroes with big blasters to save the day. She shrugged. Grandpa Han was a brave, roguish hero with a big blaster.
but he wasn't here, so she had to make sure she didn't cause any trouble she couldn't handle herself. Why had she felt this place? Grand Malaya said the Force was an energy of living things, and there would be nothing living in the tomb. She reached out toward it with her senses, again feeling that oppressive stillness. And then, the stillness was no longer still. She felt something stirring within. Not life, just motion, energy. She froze in place, willing herself to become as small and as still as possible. It waited, whatever it was, on the other side of that wall, waited with a stillness that matched hers. In the distance, Alana could hear C-3PO calling for her, and she desperately wished that she was with the droids. She took a slow step backward. The thing in the tomb did not react. She took another, and another, and bumped into the rough surface of a rock outcropping, and still nothing came bursting out of the tomb. Barely breathing, she moved into the outcropping, not even beginning to relax until the tomb was out of sight.
I can feel you.
The words crept quietly into her mind. Alana almost shrieked. They were not from the tomb. She stared up into the pinkish sky, seeing only the distant sun and a sliver of the former garrison moon. The thought came from there.
Who is there? I felt you. Please. Please.
There was such a yearning desperation to the words, such a hunger, that Alana wanted to reply, wanted to reassure whoever was there. But caution and fear and 100 lessons she had learned at her mother's knee kept her from doing so.
What is your name?
The question sent a tingle of dread down Alana's spine. She had the eerie sensation that if she responded, if she offered her name, it would be snatched away and never returned, leaving her to wander forever, not knowing who she was. She hugged herself for warmth, and keeping her head low, reined her senses in. The voice did not return, and a couple of minutes later, Alana no longer felt any hint of it. She breathed a sigh of relief. She almost bumped into C-3PO as she rounded a particularly wide stone rise. He was suddenly there, splendidly metallic and modern, R2-D2 beside him. The astromech whistled a musical greeting, sounding not at all perturbed.
Miss Amelia, you really mustn't go off alone.
She nodded, and not slowing, began heading back toward where she thought the mine buildings must be.
I know.
C-3PO hurried to keep up, the faint whining sound of his arm and leg servos increasing as he did so.
Thank the Maker you're unhurt. If I had to report to Master Han and Mistress Leia that you had come to some harm, I'm sure I'd find myself doomed to an eternity of opening ale bottles in the filthiest taproom in Coruscant's sublevels.
You keep talking about a Maker. Who made you?
Actually, I don't recall. But I was made, so the existence of my Maker is beyond question. And since I consider my existence to be a good thing, he was without a doubt benevolent and forward-thinking.
I guess.
In a large natural cave, one with several tunnels splitting off at various angles, Leia studied the sensor board, considered their options, and shook her head. She pointed straight up.
That way.
Han looked up as though he could see through both the speeder's opaque roof and the impenetrable darkness, then turned his attention to the sensors. They showed a recess in the ceiling, one that could easily be interpreted just as a natural depression in the rock. But Leia had sensed otherwise. Han put the speeder into a careful vertical ascent. The cleft was easily wide enough to accommodate the speeder at its base, but it narrowed, becoming a not quite straight chimney of sorts. As they rose, something bumped onto the roof, then scrambled free with a skittering noise. Han froze for a moment, then realized it could not have been one of the energy spiders. A spider would have attacked rather than fled. 20 meters up, the chimney widened into a broad cave, one that sloped downward to the southwest. At Leia's nod, he put the speeder on a slow, gentle course down that decline. Leia returned her attention to the sensor board, where topographic lines, constantly changing, showed the irregularities of the channel they were following.
I swear, this is all natural caves and tunnels worn by water.
Do you think Kessel had more water once upon a time?
She shook her head.
I think Kessel used to be a chunk of some other planet, a much bigger one, with seas and a thicker atmosphere. The life forms we know of here, the spiders and the avians, must have developed at that time. Can you imagine a big avian developing on this world, with an atmosphere so thin they can barely fly? But then some calamity destroyed that world, and the chunk that became Kessel is all that remains of it.
Maybe the rest of the debris fell into the maw.
The tunnel they followed continued laterally and downward for several kilometers. It was a winding course but remained broad, clearly the remains of a long-dead underground river. Eventually, Leia spotted signs on the sensor screen of fissures, vertical cracks in the rock. They shone the speeder headlights on those spots and saw that the breaks in the rock were far more recent than the surrounding stone.
Groundquakes,
Han said. As if in response, an ominous vibration filled the air. Small rocks dislodged themselves from the tunnel roof overhead and began clattering down all around the speeder and onto its roof. The rumbling, like the galaxy's largest giant tucking into a big bowl full of boulders for his breakfast, did not diminish. It intensified, the rocks crashing down on the speeder, growing from pebble-sized to fist-sized to head-sized. Han kept his hands tight on the yoke, knuckles white, ready to duck one way or another if he had enough warning of disaster. The flooring beneath them gave way. The speeder's repulsors, set to maintain an altitude of a meter above the ground, were not strong enough. Han, Leia, and their vehicle dropped into pitch blackness, with more stones and boulders following them.
City of Dorshan, Doran.
Luke could tell that Ben was finding the Temple of the Baron Doe both alien and comfortably familiar. The decor was characteristic of Keldors, a constant barrage of symbols and metaphors stylistically representing their natural surroundings and forces of nature. But the chambers had obvious purposes he instantly understood. Training halls, classrooms, meditation rooms, dining halls. It all operated on a much smaller scale than the Jedi Temple. Luke did not ask Tastora Pawn, their student guide, but estimated that there were perhaps 6 masters here and no more than 20 students of various ranks. The combat training hall was comparatively small and very lightly equipped. Staves rested on weapon racks, padded body armor hung on wall hooks. There were padded mats on the floor for practice. The hall could accommodate perhaps 2 sets of sparring pairs at a time. Ben asked Tastora Pawn,
"Don't all your students train in combat?"
"No. The Baron Doe are not a militant order like the Jedi."
"We're not that militant,"
she offered him a smile, showing her grinding palates.
"You all study fighting. That's militant. Our role is one of advice and advance warning. The first Baron Doe were village seers who had a heightened weather sense and could warn their fellows of impending storms. Over the centuries, they and their descendants corresponded with one another, exchanging techniques and philosophies. The best became personal advisors to the rulers of our kind. Eventually, the order became a scholarly one, collecting and cataloging knowledge of the arts and sciences, as well as the ways of the Force."
They passed through an angled archway into a meditation chamber, furnished only with small circular mats on the floor. The chamber had no viewports, and the walls were a soothing, rough-textured gray-white, like the inside of a cloud. Luke asked, "I've been assuming, but did not ask yesterday, that Master Plo Koon was once a member of your order." Tastora Pawn nodded. She sat on one of the foam circles, and by gesture, invited Luke and Ben to do likewise. They complied. She said,
"Over the centuries, many of the Koon family have been Baron Doe. The Force runs strong in that line, as it is said in the Skywalker line. It is said of Plo Koon that he never grew weary of living among oxygen breathers, of having to cope with claustrophobic masks and strange faces. Me, I would grow weary of it within weeks or months.
Ben tapped the transparisteel mask over his own face.
I know how you feel.
Your father will be instructed by Master Tyla Mong in the Hasat-Dur technique, which I understand you are not learning. Would you like to get in some fighting practice?
You promise not to yank my mask off this time?
No promises.
Oh well, sure.
Once the two were gone, Luke did not have long to wait. Tyla Mong entered, gestured for Luke not to rise, and sat on a pad opposite his.
One master to another, she said. You will not object to an accelerated course, devoid of learning rituals and training artifacts?
That would be most agreeable.
Well then, the technique you asked to learn is the Anasef technique of the Hasat-Dur family. In our language, the term Hasat-Dur means lightning rod.
Why do you call it that?
Because if you are not absolutely perfect in your mastery of the technique and perform Hasat-Dur during a storm, you will be repeatedly struck by lightning and killed.
Despite himself, Luke laughed. You're kidding, right? She shook her head.
The Hasat-Dur techniques suffuse your body with a very low level of electromagnetic radiation. You produce the radiation as an interaction between the Force and your own mental influence over your central nervous system. The energies a student produces early in his study of the technique attract lightning, much like a lightning rod. It is for this reason that this skill, like that of dismantling high explosives, is best perfected before it is ever attempted in the field.
Other than scrambling brain scans and permitting a rather difficult-to-solve form of suicide by lightning, what do the other Hasat-Dur techniques do?
They can disable one's own prosthetics and electronic implants, can interfere with shock shackles, can cause one to be perceived by animal senses as something terrible or something inoffensive, and can allow one to act as a very effective range-boosting antenna for comlinks. And there are other uses.
From a pocket in her robes, she drew out two objects. One looked like an ordinary sphere of durasteel, gray metal about 4 centimeters in diameter. The other was a flat plate of the same material. It had a rimmed depression that was clearly intended to accommodate the ball. An insulated cable was attached to the edge of the plate. About 1 meter long, it ended in an elastic strap with an electrical lead embedded in it. She set the plate down in front of Luke, put the ball in the depression, and handed him the elastic band.
Please attach that to your hand, placing the lead in your palm.
Luke began to comply, then thought better of it and put the strap on his flesh hand instead of the prosthetic one.
This device, Tyla Mong said, is a simple teaching tool. It is attuned to the precise intensities and frequencies of electromagnetic energy produced by someone correctly practicing the Anasef technique.
How, by the way, does Anasef translate?
Dead brain.
Luke grinned. You Baron Doe have very practical naming conventions.
Our artistic senses lean toward the tactile and visual, not verbal. For us, learning basic is always a ritual of discovery of colorful adjectives and breathtaking arrays of synonyms. Anyway, your first step is to learn to channel energies that will cause the ball to lift off the plate.
Luke looked at the ball. He allowed himself to sink into a meditative state. He resisted the urge to push at the ball with the Force. He could certainly lift it telekinetically, but that would not benefit his training. Instead, one by one, he cycled through all the Force techniques he had learned,
not utilizing them, but putting himself in the mental state required by each. Half a minute later, as he prepared for a technique that caused holocams briefly to go to static, a method by which Jedi could bypass many security setups, the ball sprang up and began spinning, bobbing up and down between 10 and 20 centimeters above the plate. Tyler Mong nodded.
Well, that's about 8 weeks of apprentice training bypassed.
But that's only the first stage. What are the others?
You learn to stop the ball from spinning. That means you have found the exact form of energy necessary for the dead brain technique. You learn to maintain the ball at an altitude of about 1 centimeter. That means you have found the correct amount of energy to exert. An amount that makes it hard for any but the most delicate and most correctly attuned devices to discover that there is any anomaly in your electromagnetic energy output. And you learn to sustain the output without tiring yourself for days, weeks, or even longer.
Is this how Jason Solo learned the technique from Corozil? Immediately, something shut down in Tyler Mong's mind. Luke wasn't sure whether someone who was not a Jedi Master would have noticed it. He wasn't even sure most Masters would have detected it. But something, the equivalent of a Durasteel vault door, slid shut within Tyler Mong's consciousness. Her face and manner betrayed no sign of it. She just said,
"Yes."
How long did it take him?
As I recall, about 3 days.
Luke smiled. It's very un-Jedi-like of me, but I want to break his record.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.